Thank you, Brother Chairman. My dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. This morning then, in the 1st of Kings chapter 4, and in those verses that Brother Eric has read for us, we're given an insight into some of the administrative details of the kingdom of Israel as it pertained under the hand of Solomon. You'll remember that in our last study we took up the last few verses of the chapter, which more specifically dealt with Solomon's wisdom and the way in which he went about inculcating the nature, the principles of those wisdom in the kingdom from verses 29 to 34. What we're now doing is coming back and taking up the balance of the chapter, the earlier part of the chapter, concerning the details of his administration. So in chapter 4 and verse 1 we read, "So King Solomon was king over all Israel, and these were the princes which he had," and it then goes on to enumerate a number of different positions. Now, here we have, in fact, an outline then of the government of Solomon in these particular verses. So we start off with a man who's the chief ruler in verse 2. It's described actually here as Azariah the son of Zadok the priest, but you'll notice in the margin that the word priest is translated here alternatively as chief officer or chief ruler, and it does appear that that is a more appropriate translation of the Hebrew word Kohen. It's used on several different occasions in the divine narrative to indicate a civil role rather than a priestly one, and we know in fact that the priests were Zadok and Abiathar, who are not going to be mentioned until verse 4. So we have Azariah, who's the chief ruler. We have in verse 3 Elihoreph and Ahiah as the secretaries or scribes, as they're called here. We have Jehoshaphat as the recorder, Benaiah over the host. We have Zadok and Abiathar as the priests, Azariah over the officers, Zabud, who's the king's friend and principal officer, over the household is Ahishar, and over the tribute is Adoniram, or also known as Adoram in several other places. So what we have here are the essential details of the government of Solomon. Now the interesting thing about this is that Solomon's government or Solomon's administration was in fact, we believe, taken from his father's planning of the kingdom. If you come back to the 2nd of Samuel chapter 8 for a moment, we have the outline of the kingdom as it existed in the days of David. And we're just going to have a look at that and see if we can just pick up from David's time the similarities with regard to the two administrations. In the 2nd of Samuel chapter 8, we're told in verse 16, perhaps verse 15, we have a very similar set of verses about the administration of David. David reigned over all Israel, and David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. 2 Samuel 8 verse 15, Joab the son of Zeruiah was over the host, Jehoshaphat was the recorder, Zadok and Ahimelech were the priests, Sarariah was the scribe, etc., etc. So we have the details of the government of David here. Now what we're going to do is just start off by way of comparison and just see if we can pick up which parts of the government are the same and where changes have occurred from the time of David. So let's just go through and see who we can pick up. You might just like to call out then from the 2nd of Samuel chapter 8 where we have something that we can fit into David's time. So who have we got here? So what you're looking for is any of these positions being, any of these positions that were being used in the time of David's government and who was responsible for that position. So who do we have? Right, so Joab's over the host, so he's here, is that right? So let's, if I just put up here David. So Joab was over the host, says the record. Right, so that's Joab. Right, anyone else? Zadok was the priest, Jehoshaphat was the recorder. Right. And Ahimelech was also a priest, so there was a double priesthood. Yep. What else? Sarai was the scribe or the secretary. How do you spell that? Well, never mind, whatever it was. I've got too many I's and A's in there, but who else is there in that record? David's sons were the chief rulers. So we have in fact the same word Cohen used here. So David's sons. Benaiah was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. So he's in there. Okay. Now what about these other ones here? Over the officers, the king's council, over the household, or over the tribute. Do we have any of those there? No, we're just about exhausted, are we? What about the 2 Samuel chapter 20 then? Because we have a later reference to the government of David in the 2 Samuel chapter 20. So if you come to the 2 Samuel 20 verse 23, now just see if you can add any further people from the list of David's government later on in his life now in the 2 Samuel chapter 20 from verses 23 to 26. Sorry? So Adoram is over the tribute, so we now have a man called Adoram mentioned. So that's a new appointment that's occurred at some stage during David's reign. Adoram, yes, over the tribute. Anything else? Yes, there's been a change of scribe to, how do you spell that? Sheva is now the scribe. Anything else? Zadok and Ahimelech has now become Zadok and Abiathar. Change in generations here. Anybody else? Ira? What's he? He's taken over the position of chief ruler up here. So we have Ira up here. All right, look, I think that's enough. In fact, there was someone else who does fit into that story, and that's a man called Hushai. Where would you put Hushai? Sorry? Yeah, Hushai was king's counsel or the king's friend, and in fact, the very term that's used in the First of Kings chapter 4, let's come back to the First of Kings chapter 4 now, the very term that's used in the First of Kings chapter 4 concerning Zabud, it says in chapter 4 and verse 5 that Zabud was the principal officer and the king's friend. And that term, the king's friend, is the same word used concerning Hushai in the 2 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 37. He was known as David's friend, and he was one of the personal counselors to the king. So all we're saying here is that we believe that the administration of Solomon was largely modelled on the government system of that of David. Many of the positions are in fact identical. Now the question is, where did David get it from? David got it from Samuel, didn't he? Because there was discussion between David and Samuel concerning the constitution of the kingdom. There is a reference to Samuel writing up the matters concerning the kingdom, and we believe that it was Samuel who laid out the administrative details of how the kingdom should function under the monarchy. He passed that on to David, and Solomon now has simply taken up those matters with regard to the structuring of his own government. But you'll notice that there's one or two changes. So let's come back now to the 1 Kings chapter 4, and we'll just pick up those changes as we come through the record. Perhaps one last thing just before we do that. If you come to the 2 Kings chapter 18 for a moment, interestingly enough, just to show how some of these functions were retained down through time, we come in the 2 Kings chapter 18 to the life of Hezekiah, and notice that in Hezekiah's day, when Rabshakeh came, that rather than the king himself going out, he sent a delegation. And the delegation is in the 2 Kings 18 and verse 18, when they had called to the king, there actually came out to them Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household. That's this position here, isn't it? over the household. So that was actually from the time of Solomon. And Shebna, who was the scribe, that's this position here, that of secretary. And lastly, Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. So in the days of Hezekiah, at least three of these functions of government were still in existence, although it would appear that the whole apparatus of government is not nearly so extensive in later times, because the glory of Israel really reached its height, of course, in the days of Solomon, and thereafter the apparatus of government slowly declined in the reign of future kings. So when we come back to the 1st of Kings chapter 4, what we're dealing with here is the height of the government of Israel at its greatest point of time. And there are one or two changes that have been brought in here from the days of David. So verse 2 says that these were the princes which Solomon had. Rotherham translates that phrase, these were his chief officers of state, for the word princes. These were his chief officers of state. Jerusalem Bible says these were his high officials, NIV, his chief officials. So the princes in verse 2 is in fact the men who formed the government administration, which then follows in the balance of verses 2 through to 6. So we have, first of all, Azariah, the son of Zadok, who in fact is the chief ruler, and that position was established in the days of David, and in the latter time of David's reign, that position was held by Ira. So he must have been, in fact, the main connection between the king and other parts of the government apparatus. They came through him. He was the principal, or the chief ruler, over the whole system of things. And then enumerated in order, in verse 3, we have Eliphareth and Ahiah, the sons of Shisha, scribes. Now, in what way is that a change from the time of David? What changes there from the 1st of Kings chapter 4 and verse 3 to that of David's previous administration? We'd like to have a stab on that. It's not actually a trick question. Well, sorry? No, well, they weren't. The scribes were never his family anyway. We're talking about the scribes now, the two men who were the scribes in verse 3. Well, the key is that David only ever had one scribe. First of all, there was Sarai. Later on, it had changed to Sheba. But Solomon, you'll notice, has two. So there has been a doubling of the role of scribes. And you see, the reason for that, of course, is that we have a vast increase in economic activity. We have commerce and industry and trade relations and state visits, and a much wider system of government was needed to cope with the demands of Solomon's empire. So instead of only having one scribe, we now have two official scribes, but later on in the days of later kings, it reverts back to one scribe again. The scribes, of course, did have the role of secretary. They wrote the king's letters, they drew up decrees, they attended to financial summaries of the nation, and there was so much going on in Solomon's day that in fact there are now two rather than one. Jehoshaphat the recorder, verse 3, well, interestingly enough, you'll notice that position was appointed in the days of David. So Solomon has simply taken up the position that his father had already created, and in fact has retained the same person in office. Jehoshaphat was appointed by David and not by Solomon, probably appointed by David towards the end of David's reign, so that Jehoshaphat was perhaps still reasonably fresh in the position. Now, what did the recorder do rather as opposed to the scribe? The scribes attended to the writing of letters and the drawing up of decrees and announcements and financial summary. What did the recorder do? Yes, the recorder was really the historian of the nation. You see, the margin says he was in fact the remembrancer. He was the analyst, or the, I don't mean analyst in the sense of financial, and he was the annalist, A-N-N-A-L, the writer of annals, the writer of the history of the nation, the keeper of the state records. You'll remember on another occasion when one of the kings of Persia couldn't sleep, remember that he called for the books of of the history of the nation to be brought, and certain matters were brought to his attention that night concerning a coup that had taken place. Someone wrote down all the affairs of the nation as a record, and that was the job of the recorder. So in a similar way, we have the recorder of the ecclesia who writes down minutes and probably actually doesn't keep quite as full a book concerning the history of the ecclesia today. We'd have some very interesting books had such a record been kept. Verse 4 says that Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the host. So Benaiah, of course, has superseded who from the days of David? Well, he's taken over from Joab. Why has Benaiah taken over from Joab? Because Joab is actually no longer alive. Why is Joab no longer alive? Because Benaiah has actually slain him at the command of Solomon. And because Benaiah was previously in charge of the Cherethites and the Pelethites, which was part of the army, one of the elite guards of the army, when he assumed the role of captain of the host under Solomon's administration, he simply amalgamated under him the function of also looking after the Cherethites and the Pelethites, because he already had control of them. And so this office here, that of being over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, disappears out of Solomon's administration because Benaiah is now in control of the army, so he amalgamates those two functions together. And then we have Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, in verse 4. Azariah, verse 5, the son of Nathan, was over the officers. So here we have another new position that was created by Solomon, a man who was in charge of the officers. Probably, we don't know, but it's possible that the Nathan here was perhaps Nathan the prophet, and that Azariah was one of the sons. And the part of the officers that reported to him were no doubt the officers of verse 7. Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel. Here in verse 5 we have the man who's in charge of all the officers. So the officers of the various districts of the nation all reported back to one man, and that man was Azariah the son of Nathan, who in fact coordinated all of that reporting work back to the king. That's a new function that's been established here in the days of Solomon. Zabud the son of Nathan was principal officer and the king's friend, and so therefore to a certain extent he's taken up the role of Hushai, although there has been a bit of a change, because in the days of David there were actually three counsellors that David had. Anyone know who David's three counsellors were? He had three of them. Ahithophel was one. Hushai was another. The third one might be a bit hard to get. It was actually a man called Jonathan, his own uncle. They were the three counsellors of David. Now it appears that the whole section of the counsellors has, well, one would at first sight imagine that the king's counsellors have disappeared from the government of Solomon. But I think in fact that what probably happened was, rather than the role of the counsellors diminishing, that they were probably actually expanded into a larger group from three outwards. If you come to the 12th chapter for a moment, you'll recall this phrase here, in the days of Rehoboam, immediately after Solomon, and this could possibly be a reference to the role of the counsellors, an enlarged group that actually stood before Solomon. It says in the 1st of Kings 12 and verse 6, "And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, how do you advise that I may answer this people?" Verse 8, "He forsook the counsel of the old men." So it appears that there was in fact perhaps a larger group of men who were in fact the counsellors of Solomon that stood before him and gave advice. Whereas David had only three, there appeared to be perhaps an enlarging of that in the days of Solomon. Now just another reference to add to that, which you might just like to take a note of, Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 14, which is one of Solomon's own proverbs, mind you, and he says, "Where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counsellors there is safety." In the multitude of counsellors there is safety. Proverbs 11 verse 14. So if in fact that's a proverb of Solomon and that was the thinking of the king, then we may reasonably conclude that the role of counsellors, which only of which there were only three in the days of David, was in fact expanded now into a greater group who advised the king. Even Solomon, in all his wisdom, recognized the value of sensible counsel from other people. So verse 6 goes on to say, in the first of Kings chapter 4, and Ahisha was over the household. And this again, you'll notice, is a further new appointment now in the days of Solomon. Because the royal household, of course, was greatly enlarged. There were all sorts of state officials and people of responsibility. There was a large palace compound. There was a startlingly large number of women roaming around who were all wives of the king. The whole apparatus of government now needed proper coordination, and so we now have a man who's over the whole of the royal household. And finally, in verse 6, Adoniram, the son of Abdar, was over the tribute. Now, Adoniram is in fact the same man as Adoram from the days of David. Adoram is simply a contracted version of the term Adoniram. So the man over the tribute was also, we believe, initially appointed by David. In fact, he actually was responsible for the coordination of the tribute during the life of three kings. He was appointed by David. He was in charge of the tribute under David. He was still in charge of the tribute under Solomon. And he was also in charge of the tribute under Rehoboam. Does anyone know what actually happened to Adoniram? Yes, he. In the end, of course, the people got fairly upset with Solomon's tax system, and Adoniram was actually sent out on one occasion to appease the people. That was the wrong choice. To send the tax officer out was not a good choice, and they actually stoned him, and so Adoniram finally met his death. Inland Revenue's never been a good department to work in, really. And so, if you come back to the first of Kings chapter 4 and verse 6, just notice this, though, that the word tribute there, in fact, may have a slightly wider connotation than it first appears. One would imagine that the term tribute initially applies to the subject of taxation and revenue, but you'll notice this word levy in the margin as an alternative translation. He was over the levy. Now, if you come across to the fifth chapter, we find that the word levy is used again, and in a rather interestingly different context. In the 1st of Kings chapter 5, in verse 13, it says, and King Solomon raised a levy, same word, out of all Israel. But you see what the margin says? A tribute of men. A tribute of men. So it wasn't just a monetary tribute, it could also be a levy on men. So King Solomon raised a levy out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men, and he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month by courses. A month they were in Lebanon, and 2 months at home. Not a bad sort of job arrangement, really. And Adoniram was over the levy. So you see, he wasn't just in charge of taxation, he was in charge, in fact, of the men who were levied by Solomon for the building projects, specifically, of course, the temple. Verse 15 goes on to say, and Solomon had 70,000 that bear burdens, and 80,000 hewers in the mountains, beside the chief of Solomon's officers, which were over the work, 3,300. So, in fact, when we add all those numbers up, we have 70,000 burden bearers. Verse 15. How many is that? That's 70,000. We have 80,000 stone hewers. That's 80,000, and we also have another levy of 30,000, although only 10,000 are on at any point of time. So in fact we have a total workforce that was committed to the temple project and later to other things of 160,000 people. But of those, only 10,000 were Israelites at any point of time, verses 13 and 14. If you come to the 1st of Kings chapter 9, however, no, perhaps the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 2 would be better. In the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 2, we find that the other 150,000 of the total of 160 were in fact a levy of strangers in the land. So we're told in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 17, and Solomon numbered all the strangers that were in the land of Israel, after the numbering wherewith David his father had numbered them, and they were found 150,000. He set 70,000 to be bearers of burden, 80,000 to be hewers in the mountains. So here we have the same numbers as the first of Kings chapter 5, but we're specifically told here that they were in fact all strangers. Verse 17. So there were 10,000 Israelites under levy, but 150,000 strangers that were employed by Solomon on his building projects, and Adoniram was in charge not just of taxation, but in charge of all of this levied tribute upon the strangers concerning their employment under the hand of Solomon. When the temple was finished, we believe that those same people were actually redeployed onto other projects. If you come to the first of Kings chapter 9, we're told there that in the first of Kings chapter 9 and verse 15, this is the reason of the levy which King Solomon raised for to build the house of Yahweh. So there was the original reason, but also to build his own house and Milo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hatzor and Megiddo and Giza. And verse 20 says, and all the people that were left of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, which were not of the children of Israel, their children that were left after them in the land, whom the children of Israel also were not able utterly to destroy, upon those did Solomon levy a tribute of bond service unto this day. So there's where the 150,000 people have come from. They are the remnants of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites that were still in existence in the land. And most of these were in fact given to be hewers of stone. Now, that sort of reminds us of another group actually. What does that sort of remind us of from earlier times, scripturally? Yes, it reminds us of the Gibeonites. Now, whereabouts is that? That's in Joshua chapter 9, isn't it? We might just have a look at that. Joshua did something very similar, didn't he, with the Gibeonites, except they weren't hewers of stone, they were something else. Joshua chapter 9 tells us in verses 26 and 27, and so he did unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, that they slew them not, but he in fact made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of Yahweh, even unto this day in the place which he should choose. What did they later come to be known as? The Gibeonites? They came to be known as the Nephilim. Yes, coming from someone who I know has done a small project on that matter. So let's just summarise what we've found there. We have a reference, therefore, to the servants of Solomon. Just as the Nephilim were made hewers of wood, Joshua chapter 9, so now we have other people being made now hewers of stone. In fact, you'll find that it was David that began the practice in the first of Chronicles chapter 22 verse 2, but what Solomon has done now is to extend that into a very large group of people, first of Kings chapter 5 and second of Chronicles chapter 2, and that they were later redeployed onto other projects. Now, interestingly enough, when the return from the exile occurred under Ezra and Nehemiah, and we might just turn to just one of these references because our time is running out, but in Nehemiah chapter 11 and verse 3, we have, we believe, a reference to this group of people upon whom Solomon levied a tribute of bond service. Nehemiah chapter 11 verse 3 says, and now these are the chief of the province that dwelt in Jerusalem, but in the cities of Judah everyone dwelt in his possession in their cities, to wit, Israel, the priests, the Levites, the Nethinim, and the children of Solomon's servants. So we have a particular group here known as the children of Solomon's servants. And we believe that that group, Solomon's servants, were in fact the 150,000 strangers from the remnants of the other nations that he levied, and here they are now at the time of the return from the exile. They are still a recognizable body, and they came in back to the land with Ezra and Nehemiah. Why did Ezra and Nehemiah bring the children of Solomon's servants back with them? Why? Well, because they're hewers of stone, and they're going back to rebuild the wall and to rebuild the temple. So back with Ezra and Nehemiah went the Nethinim, the hewers of wood, and Solomon's servants, the hewers of stone. So right through until the return after the exile, this group of people, this group of bond slaves that laboured under Solomon, are still to be found in the history of the nation. Now, why have we looked at all of that? You can have a look at that later on. Why have we looked at all of that? Well, because, interestingly enough, what we're saying, therefore, is that a large part of the building activity of the temple, because it was such a vast undertaking, was in fact organised by means of this tribute upon the strangers. So we're told, for example, here, in the record, one of which we've read this morning, that Solomon numbered all the strangers, and he set 70,000 of them to be bearers of burdens and hewers of stone in the mountains. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that in all of this we have an echo of the time of Christ, don't we? Because Isaiah chapter 60 takes up that story and says, "And the sons of strangers shall build thy walls, and their king shall minister unto thee. Therefore thy gates shall be open continually, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles." That word forces, by the way, in Isaiah is normally translated wealth, but in fact the word can relate to a multitude of people, the hosts of people. The hosts of the Gentiles are brought unto Israel, and some of those hosts are used in the building projects. And Zechariah chapter 6, it takes up a similar theme when it says, "They that are far off," that's a term for Gentiles, isn't it, "shall come and build in the temple of Yahweh." That all was born out of the story of Solomon's servants, the sons of strangers, that were brought together in order to help build the temple in his own day. So these things are all going to be seen to have a foreshadowing that points forward to the work of Christ in the age to come. So coming back then to the 1st of Kings chapter 4, we pick up the record again then at the end of that those first few verses on the government of Solomon, and we move on to the next section of the chapter. 1st of Kings chapter 4, and now we've come to verse 7. And from this, so verses 1 to 6 really gives us the story of Solomon's government. Now from verses 7 to 19, we have the detail of Solomon's administrators. And in fact, what happened here was, well, let's have a look at what verse 7 says. It says that Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel, which provided victuals for the king and his household, each man his month in a year made provision, and these are their names. Now, what we have therefore is 12 men, but they're not, these 12 men are not in fact over the 12 tribes. They are in fact, that might be a little bit faint, but they are in fact over 12 districts. They are no longer over the tribes. It's true that some of the districts are similar to tribal divisions, but as a general principle, we have now the land of Israel being broken up in quite a different way. So we have in verse 8, notice the margin, by the way, for verse 8, we have Ben-Hur. And Ben-Hur, he actually is in Mount Ephraim, this main section in the middle here. And then in verse 9, we have the son of Dekar, in Makaz and Shaalbim and Beth Shemesh and Elon Beth Hanan, which is this region down over here, a little to the south, bordering on the Philistines. Then in verse 3 we have the son of Hesed. To him pertains Socho and all the land of Hether, which is this region a little further to the north on the coastal plain. Then in verse 4 we have the son of Abinadab, and he has all the region of Dor, which is further up again in the land that actually lies to the side of the Carmel range. And notice that he in fact is a son-in-law of Solomon, because he married Tarphath, the daughter of Solomon, verse 11. And then in verse 12 we have Baana, the son of Ahilud, to him between Taanach and Megiddo and Beth-shan, which is this central region, of course, coming down through the Jezreel Valley and the Valley of Esdraelon down into the Jordan Valley. By the way, you'll notice that he's the son of Ahilud, or Ahilud, and that's also the same name in verse 3. So one would assume that Baana of verse 12 is probably the brother of the recorder, Jehoshaphat, their father in both cases being Ahilud. And then in verse 13 we have the son of Geba in Ramoth-Gilead. And that takes us now over the River Jordan to this region on the other side, the region of Bashan, 70 great cities with walls and brazen bars. In verse 14 we have Ahinadab, the son of Iddo, who had Mahanaim, and that's this region further down here, still on this side, however, but down in the lowland area on the other side of Jordan. Verse 15 says that Ahimaaz was in Naphtali, also another son-in-law of the king. So we've now moved north again, up to this region here, to the land of Naphtali. We then have in verse 16, Baana, the son of Hushai, probably David's friend, by the way. Baana, his son, was in Asher. And that takes us over to the coastal region here, bordering alongside Tyre. Jehoshaphat, the son of Peruah, verse 17, in Issachar, which is this region down here, just under the Sea of Galilee. Shimei, the son of Elah, verse 18, in Benjamin. We've now come back down to the region of Jerusalem again. And lastly, in verse 19, Geba, the son of Uri, or Uri, was in the country of Gilead, in the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. So he's actually down in this area here, on the other side, Jordan, which not only was the region of Og and Sihon, but also bordered the land of the Ammonites and the Moabites. And yet, despite all of those opposing, turbulent nations, the record says in verse 19 at the end of the verse, and yet for all of that, he was only one officer in that area. There was only one officer for that whole area, despite the fact there were at least three or four opposing countries. So what it's telling us is the tremendous power that was exerted in the days of Solomon. There was truly peace on all sides. The surrounding nations were very much under the control of Solomon at this stage. Now, all of these things, in fact, we believe, were foreshadowed by David again. If you come back to the first of Chronicles and chapter 27, David had a slightly different organization, but we believe that it was again the basis for what Solomon takes up here. Bearing in mind, as we made the point before, that if David, in fact, had the details of the administration from Samuel, and Samuel had them from God, then, in fact, what we have here is certain aspects of the administration of the kingdom which are divinely ordained. Now, in the first of Chronicles, chapter 27, we're told, in fact, that David had two sets of 12 rulers. First of all, we're told from verse 16, 1 of Chronicles 27, verse 16, and through to verse 22, we're given there the fact that there was, that David had a ruler over each tribe, and that man was responsible for the administration of the kingdom under the overall rule of David. So there were 12 princes or rulers, one over each of the tribes. But in addition to that, verse 25 tells us that over the king's treasures was Azmaveth, the son of Adiel, and over the storehouses in the fields and the cities and the villages and in the castles was Jehonathan, that's two. Over them that did the work of the field for tillage of the ground was Esri, that's three. Over the vineyards was Shimei, that's four. Over the increase of the vineyards for the wine cellars was Zabdi, that's five. Over the olive trees and sycamore trees was Baal-Hanan, that's six. Over the cellars of oil was Joash, that's seven. Over the herds that fed in Sharon was Shittri, that's eight. Over the herds that were in the valleys of Shaphat was Shaphat the son of Adlai, that's nine. Over the camels was Obal, that's ten. Over the asses was Jehadiah, that's 11. And over the flocks was Jaziz the Hagarite, that's 12. All these were the rulers of the substance. So David had 12 princes over the tribes, but he also had 12 officers that looked after all of the lands, vineyards, olive yards, animals. The whole of the substance of the kingdom was administered by 12 officers. Now, what Solomon appeared to do was bring those two ideas together. And so instead of having 12 rulers over the 12 tribes and then 12 men who looked after the resources of the kingdom, Solomon in fact amalgamated those two, said, no, we won't have 12 princes over the tribes. What we'll have is 12 administrative districts, and those 12 men will be the governors of the district and also in charge of all the resources of the kingdom in that area. Why do you think Solomon chose to use administrative districts rather than tribes? Any thoughts on that? Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. I agree with that, and I think one of the things about the peace was there was also to be peace amongst the tribes. And in order to remove tribal jealousies, what Solomon did was break the country up in a totally different way. So instead of having the tribes who were often antagonistic towards one another with regards to preeminence, he simply broke the whole place up into administrative districts. Just that matter of the war footing. And notice, by the way, that in the system of government we have here from chapter 4 verse 2, we have first of all the chief ruler and then the scribes and the recorder. But if you look at the system of government under David, you'll notice that the person who's first mentioned in the system of government on both occasions is Joab, who's over the host or the army. So Joab, the captain of the army, ranks first in the government of David. In the government of Solomon, the secretaries and the scribes and the recorder come first, those who are in charge of the written affairs of the nation. It is indeed a time for peace. Well, obviously the system worked, because we're told in verse 27 of the first of Kings 4, and those officers... Now, that must be the officers from verse 7, mustn't it? So we've come back now to those same men. Those officers, yes, they did provide victual for King Solomon, and for all that came under King Solomon's table, every man in his month, they lacked nothing. Barley also and straw for the horses and dromedaries brought they unto the place where the officers were, every man according to his charge. So the system of administration that Solomon designed, according to this chapter anyway, it worked perfectly well. Nobody had any lack of anything. Each month, the governor of one district was responsible not only for the administration of his district, but for the lands and pastures of the area, for the flocks and herds and the olive yards and orchards, and was responsible also for providing sufficient for the king's table. And so they did, says the record, and nobody lacked anything. The whole thing worked together, in fact, perfectly. Now, in the kingdom age, the story will be slightly different, because we're told, aren't we, in the book of Ezekiel chapter 48, that there will in fact be tribal cantons again. But we're also told in Isaiah chapter 11 that whilst the nation will be divided back into tribal cantons again, we're specifically told in Isaiah chapter 11, let me just get the phrase, it says there in verse 13, the envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. So although in the kingdom age we will go back to a system of tribal cantons, there will be no tribal jealousies in the future, says Isaiah. They will already have been utterly removed anyway. Now, having set up the tribal cantons again in Ezekiel 48, we still need the governors over the regions as Solomon had, and of course that takes us into the New Testament, doesn't it? So here we have another echo coming forward into the reign of Christ. In the first of Kings 4, we're told here, and Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel. And the Lord says to the disciples in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 28, in the regeneration ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel, because we're now back to tribal cantons, Ezekiel chapter 48. But the modelling, the idea of the administration, all centred on 12 rulers, is of course taken from the story of Solomon's kingdom here in the 1st of Kings chapter 4. Actually, this word here is an interesting one, I think, in this context. In the regeneration, says Christ. What's the regeneration? What does the term regeneration mean? Yes, it is, and it does convey that sense in the Greek as well. Regeneration can be equated with restoration as one of its meanings. And the whole point is, and this is what we believe as Christadelphians, isn't it? Is the government of Christ is going to be a restoration of something that's been in the past. The kingdom of God has existed before. Here it is. The kingdom of God in the 1st of Kings chapter 4 is going to be regenerated upon the earth tomorrow, in the time of Christ's government. And so in the regeneration, when the same system of government in a sense is established, we're going to have 12 officers over the land again, and it's going to be the 12 apostles, one of which won't be Judas. So therefore, who's going to take Judas's place? What was his name? Matthias from Acts chapter 1 obviously will therefore have the privilege of ruling over one of the tribes of Israel in the age to come. And these similar words in Luke 22, I appoint unto you a kingdom that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And so of course one of the things that we've always said, isn't it, as Christadelphians is, how can you understand the Old Testament, or the New Testament rather, if you don't understand the Old? So much of the Old is modelled on the New, and here certainly, of course, in the story of the kingdom under Solomon, which is so clearly a foreshadowing of Christ's reign, all of these things, that the richness of them is only apparent if we have the roots of it back in Old Testament times here. Now, that brings us to verse 20, the 1st of Kings chapter 4 and verse 20. And in fact, what we're going to do now is just have a look at several other echoes that now occur. So what we have now from verses 20 to 25 is a general description now of the nation and what it was like in the days of Solomon. How did the nation feel? What was the kingdom like? What was the spirit of the people of the day? Well, it says, Judah and Israel were many, as the sand which is by the sea in multitude. They ate, they drank, they made merry. Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river unto the land of the Philistines. They brought presents, they served him, there was ample provisions. They had peace on all sides, verse 24. They dwelt safely, verse 25. They dwelt under their vines and fig trees, verse 25, all the days of Solomon. So verses 20 to 25 is really a marvellous description, isn't it, of the absolute happiness and contentment and joy that filled the kingdom in the time of Solomon, the skillful administrator. He was wise in the organization of all of these things so that the affairs of government were so regulated that the nation enjoyed absolute contentment and prosperity under him, as will the nation in the time of Christ. Now let's just look, I'll tell you what, there's a whole lot of allusions here There's a wealth of scriptural idea here in these verses. Let's just look at several of them. Here's the first one. So taking up the 1st of Kings chapter 4 here, verse 20 and verse 25. We're told that Judah and Israel were as the sand by the sea. Well, that's not too difficult to work out, is it? Because the sand by the sea is, of course, Genesis chapter 22, verse 17, isn't it? I will multiply thy seed as the sand which is upon the seashore. So Judah and Israel being as the sand is the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. This is the multitudinous seed of Israel that have all been multiplied by the promise given to Abraham. And what are they like? Well, it says, Judah and Israel dwelt safely, says verse 25, and that's actually Jeremiah 23, verse 6. In his days, Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. Now, Jeremiah 23, of course, is another chapter about the glories of the reign of Christ. And then it says that every man dwelt under his vine and under his fig tree. Well, that of course is Micah 4, isn't it? They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. So we have this tremendous sense of peace and security in the nation under the wise governorship and administratorship of Solomon the good king. And you can see how that clearly the whole wording of the first of Kings 4 is being taken here as a basis for many another Bible reference which picks up the spirit of those words and says, look, this is actually really talking about the reign of Christ to come. So what about verse 21? Verse 21 says, and Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river unto the land of the Philistines and unto the border of Egypt, and they brought presents and served Solomon all the days of his life. Well, he reigned where? Over all kingdoms from the river, that's the river Euphrates, unto the land of the Philistines and unto the border of Egypt. He reigned over all kingdoms. That's Romans 15 verse 12. He shall rise to reign over the Gentiles. Romans 15 verse 12, by the way, is quoting from Isaiah chapter 11, the rod out of the stem of Jesse that shall come. So Christ is going to do just that, says Paul in Romans. He's going to arise and to reign over the Gentiles, just as Solomon reigned over all kingdoms of the Gentiles. And how far will it be? From the river Euphrates unto the border of Egypt. That's Genesis 15 again, isn't it? Verse 18. Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. So the dimensions of Solomon's kingdom here, as recorded for us in verse 21, are the dimensions of the land promised to Abraham. This is a fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises when Solomon reigns over a kingdom to this extent. And then the record says, and they brought presents and served Solomon all his life, and that's Psalm 72 verses 10 and 11, which says, the kings of the earth shall bring presents, shall offer gifts, all kings shall fall down before him, all nations shall serve him, says the psalmist in Psalm 72, speaking of course in the first instance of the very reign of Solomon, but looking forward to the future reign of Messiah. So you can see how that in all of these references in the first of Kings chapter 4, there is a deliberate foreshadowing of the administration of the kingdom in the time of Christ and of the peace and contentment that will prevail as a result of his wise administration. We're told in the in another place here, his name, says the first of Chronicles 22 verse 9, shall be Solomon. Why was he called Solomon? Because I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. So Solomon, Shalom, Shalomo, means peaceable. And here, notice in the first of Kings chapter 4 and verse 24, the very last phrase, and yes, he had peace on all sides round about him. So Solomon's name was outworked, and Israel enjoyed a tremendous time of peace and prosperity. And that's Isaiah chapter 9, isn't it? And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called the Prince of Shalom. Of the increase of his government and of his peace there shall be no end. So Isaiah says there shall be no end to the increase of his peace. The book of Kings says there was peace on all sides. It's the same spirit, isn't it? Abundant peace. Where does that come from? Abundant peace, abundance of peace, so long as the moon endureth. That's Psalm 72 again, isn't it? And so Solomon's name, the peaceable or peaceful one, becomes a marvellous foreshadowing here of the story of Christ's reign. Well, brothers and sisters, that's the first of Kings chapter 4, very briefly, in verses 1 to 28. It's tremendous, isn't it, how in all of these details there is this wonderful foreshadowing of the reign of Christ. And the thing is that We don't know, of course, the exact circumstances of Christ's system of government, but one would like to think, and this I just like to conclude with this thought for you to go away on, one would like to think that perhaps some of these positions will in fact be reinstituted in the days of Christ, and that it's an interesting thing to reflect upon some of those positions and who might hold them. So there were many, many officers under the administration of Solomon's government. So there will be, of course, in the days of Christ. So what particular job do you have in mind for the kingdom? Who, me? Yes, you. In other words, have we ever thought about what we might like to be in the kingdom? Would you like to be involved with the matters of secretaryship, or something to do with counselling, or over household matters? What have you thought about with regard to the position you might play in the kingdom? It helps to make the kingdom real to us if we can see it as a real system of government that will need real people exercising real functions. All sorts of different jobs will really need to be filled. Now, which one are you going to apply for? And what are we doing in our life today to maybe develop the skills to apply for that job in the age to come? You know what I'm saying, it won't be quite that way, but for a job today, we say, well, in order for me to apply for that job, I see that the advertisement says it's got to have the following skills and qualifications. Well, what do you want to do in the kingdom? There's no reason why we shouldn't think about that. And those positions will be filled by someone. Who do you think the king's friend will be? Well, maybe there might be a number of different people. Abraham, John, who lay on the bosom of Jesus and was his dear friend. Oh, look, there's all sorts of interesting names that you could put against some of these functions. It will be there. It will be real just like that. And God willing, brothers and sisters, and in God's good grace, we may also have opportunity to participate in some of those things ourselves. When the government shall be upon the shoulder of Christ and of the increase of his peace, there shall be no end.